Hard financial decisions are facing universities trying to balance the books and deliver full student services next year. This after each 2020 semester has been affected with COVID disruptions, lockdowns and online learning. 2 months ago, polytechnics and universities warned an expected leap in domestic enrolments next year would not make up for the loss of foreign students due to the pandemic. They are already talking about financial problems in 2021, despite big increases in mid-year enrolments and the expectation of more New Zealand students next year. Last week, it was announced that 250 PhD and postgraduate students would be allowed back into the country, but they'll have to pay for their own quarantine. Most are expected to arrive in the new year. This has been welcomed as an important first step by the cash-strapped education sector, but universities admit they still don't know how many will take up the offer. Voluntary redundancies are likely at the Auckland, Waikato and Victoria universities following the dramatic downturn in international students, and science staff at NASA University have been warned of job losses and that some specialist courses face the chop. Auckland, Waikato and Massey have declined to be interviewed this morning. But with us are the Vice-Chancellor of Victoria University, Professor Grant Guildford. Good morning.
Morning.
And the University of Otago's outgoing Chancellor, Professor Harlene Hayne. Good morning.
Morena.
A little later we'll hear from the Tertiary Education Union for their take on what is happening. But first, can each of you give us an insight into what's happening in your own institution and at the sector and in the sector overall. Can you quantify the effect of COVID 2020 disruption on student numbers, Professor Guildford?
So, yes, across the university, or across the tertiary sector, there's about 120,000 international students normally come into the country each year, and so that's the number of students that can no longer come in on an annual basis. What we've got is a lot of students retained in the country at the moment. So in our institution, about 80% of those students that we would normally enrol remain, and they are enrolling in postgrad study and hopefully will stay for a bit longer, but they're not being replenished. So the pipeline is running out, if you like.
What has that meant directly for your financial situation? What's the gap that's left?
So we're forecasting for the year end a $19 million loss for this year, and were we not to intervene, it would be an additional $30 to $40 million loss next year.
So what have you been told or asked by your board to do?
So we've been given a two-year runway to try and return the university to a break-even position rather than the 3% surplus that we normally would make. And to do that, we have started with voluntary approaches such as early retirements, and we will soon be announcing a voluntary redundancy, staff giving programs, pay restraint, so things like voluntary pay cuts and the like. We've put in place a 6% reduction of budgets for the next year, so that's the operational side. And we've also put a big focus on revenue. So obviously this is a deficit that we're trying to chase, not just costs. So if we can improve our revenue, replace the revenue, then there's less we have to cut.
How do that other than through domestic students? What are you trying to do?
So domestic student recruitment and retention is key, but also we're moving into much more assertively into the workplace learning space. We've launched a new venture, Wellington Uni Ventures, which will be focusing more on that nano-credentials and the workplace learning. We're also what's called pivoting our international program to transnational education, whereby we do a lot of online education through partners offshore who deliver our teaching.
The cuts that are proposed then, how much of your previous year's revenue would they represent?
They would represent, that's a 6% of expenditure is what they represent, yeah.
So what's the likely impact on staffing numbers is what I'm getting at.
It's difficult to know as yet, so we're in a voluntary phase. We're expecting upwards. So let me, if I was just to attack this $30 to $40 million deficit by staff cuts alone, which we're not going to do, I hasten to add, that would translate to in the order of about 280 full-time staff equivalents. If we're successful with our revenue, and of course we are successful with the voluntary redundancies, then the forced redundancies will be very small in number.
What do you estimate the impact's going to be across the sector?
Well, across the sector, New Zealand universities are looking at a $600 million loss next year. And so if you think about that across the university, across the sector, in terms of staffing numbers, again, if that was all the universities were going to do, then you quite quickly get into the 2,000 to 3,000 staff headcount. So if you put that into full-time staff equivalents, it's significantly less, around about 1,000 to 1,500.
And is that what it's looking like at the moment? Because there'll be some ups and there'll be some downs. Some will do well on the revenue side, some will be more exposed.
Do you think
it's looking at 1,000 FTE?
No, I don't think so. I think the universities are being successful with their international pivots and also with their domestic enrolments, and helped in part because with the economy slowing, there's always a counter-cyclical effect with domestic enrolments.
Those international pivots, is this where we've seen a lot of full-time and of online, in fact, in some instances increasingly online only?
Yes.
Usually, and that's enabling them to keep their international clientele paying?
That's right. So online through partners. So you still have a face-to-face teaching program, but it's offshore. And the key difference is that the students may not come to New Zealand in the first 1 or 2 years of their program, but might come only later.
All right. Thank you. Stay with us, Grant Guildford. Harlene Hayne, could I bring you in? What is Otago situation, please?
Well, Otago's situation is slightly different from the other New Zealand universities for a couple of reasons. The first is that we were not nearly as exposed to the international student market. Historically, we've had a cap on international student numbers, and so it represents about 7% of our total revenue. So the losses that we're seeing, but we are seeing them, are not as severe as some of the other New Zealand universities are currently experiencing. But the other thing that Otago did was essentially take its pain up front. So some of the changes that the other New Zealand universities are contemplating right now are changes that we enacted prior to COVID. So we matched our student numbers to our staff numbers in various parts of the universities. We completely reorganized our professional service provision across the university. And so that put us in a much stronger position going into COVID.
You're still going to take something like a $10 million hit, are you?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were budgeting. I mean, each university also needs to make a substantial surplus every year so that we can keep the lights on and the buildings operational. So at Otago, that number needs to be about $25 million. And we're forecasting right now we might hit a break-even point by the end of the year, but I doubt it. And certainly next year we are forecasting a deficit.
If you've capped at 7%, how exposed are the most exposed?
No, well, we capped at 15%,
but
it represented 7% of our revenue.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's where we were, and we were actually probably at about 12% at the time of COVID. But as Professor Guildford has mentioned, many of our international students were already here. So the biggest hits aren't necessarily going to be in 2020. They're going to be in 2021 when new students won't be allowed to join us.
How exposed are the most exposed universities, Grant?
The most exposed universities, percentage-wise, it would be Lincoln University at around about 45%, sometimes 50% of international.
Is that role or revenue?
That's role.
That's role,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then in terms of scale, the University of Auckland has the most international students, so has the most money at stake.
Right, and its percentage role?
It's around about 17 to 18%, I believe.
All right. Mm. Harlene Hayne, if I could come back to you, does your situation then of near break-even, although you're forecasting deficit ahead, does that have implications for redundancies, or are you going to avoid those?
Well, we're going to try to avoid them as much as possible. As I said, we took our redundancy pathway prior to COVID by getting our house in order, and that's really a result of some of the really systemic problems in funding New Zealand universities. So we took some brave decisions, you know, last year and the year before and the year before that. So I'm really hopeful that those decisions are going to put us in the position where we're not going to have to cut. But I completely understand why other universities are taking the path that they are right now.
Is this sector too exposed to international student income, Harlene?
I mean, I think what we need to think about is that this is a sane response to an insane funding system. So New Zealand universities are really forced to bridge the gap between the rising cost of tertiary education and the amount of income that we can actually earn. The New Zealand government controls both price and volume for domestic students. Our costs for compliance, earthquake strengthening, a whole host of biosafety and security measures, which are really important, are incredibly expensive. So we do need to find a way to pay the bills. And the way in which most New Zealand universities have tried to bridge that gap is by bringing in full-fee-paying international students.
Can we talk about the difference between capital and operational? Because some of these universities have good assets. Now, can that be converted to assist at times like this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I'm sitting in my office looking at my chemistry building right now and wondering who I could sell it to and for what purpose. University assets are usually purpose-built on university campuses, and they're not the kind of real estate that you could sell for, you know, apartment conversions. So I think this mythology that we're all sitting on a number of assets that we could convert into cash is really a misunderstanding of the kind of capital assets that we all own.
Just hold that thought for a moment. Grant Guildford, and obviously you've got real estate in Wellington that's the subject of endless conversations. Do some universities have assets they could realise at this time?
Very little. So we only have assets around our of scale around our core operations, teaching and research. We've gone through and sold what we can, which was a small number of houses in Arrow Valley, and we're looking to see if there's anything else we can find in the cupboard. But not significantly. That will not affect the conduct of teaching or research.
But the Gordon Hunter Flats and the land around that and the plans you have for that, and it's for a city that's busy looking for land to build on?
If someone would buy that, yes, with a building on it that is difficult to remove, quite a challenge.
So would you sell it if you could?
It would depend on what happens in the when we go through the court process on whether that building can be removed or not.
Hailene, come back to what you're saying, and I appreciate you're leaving for a new role in Australia. I don't know whether that's out of frustration at some of these things, is it?
No, not at all. No, not at all. My term as a vice chancellor here was coming to an end next year, so this is just an opportunity to have one more big job before I finish.
So when it comes to the funding of this system, could you be specific about where the stresses are that, it appears, have made some institutions very heavily dependent on overseas student income?
Yeah, so as I said before, the government currently controls both the price and the volume. So they control what we can charge students in terms of tuition, and they also control the number of students that we can teach. So anyone who owns a business will know that kind of situation puts us in the invidious position that it's really impossible for us to cover our costs. And right now, for 2021, government has capped the SAC increase to 1.6%, and they've capped the increase on tuition fees at 1.1%, where university costs are rising at a rate that is substantially larger than that. So just to give you, by way of one small example, the electronic resources that we have for our libraries, which are probably one of the most important things that we purchase, the increase in cost for those electronic resources range from 4 to 20% for next year. If you look at other things that are happening, many universities are working quite hard in increasing the participation of Māori and Pacifica students and students with disabilities, and they're working really hard on achieving successful outcomes for those students. At Otago, we spend three times as much money as we get from government to facilitate learning in those three groups. The list goes on and on. I mean, the costs of running these organizations increase exponentially at a time when government really controls the amount of money that we can bring in. So the only sane response that many universities have been able to come up with is to bring in full fee-paying students.
What was the first number to which you referred, please? Was it SAC at 1.6%? What is that referred to?
Yeah, so that's the money that government pays us to teach the students. So that's the student achievement component. So that's what the TEC gives us to teach chemistry or English or history. And then on top of that, the students pay a tuition fee, which is the money that we get, essentially, those two components to teach.
How have you then managed to cap your exposure at Otago to 15% of role, 7% of revenue?
I mean, we have paid a huge price for that decision. We haven't had the ability to do $200 million worth of deferred maintenance. There's a whole host of things that Otago could not do because we didn't have the large numbers of international students. So, and that really was part of the reason that we reorganized our deck chairs in the previous years. We didn't have the income to support our increasing costs, so we had to cut staff numbers, both in the academic and the professional divisions, in order to make ends meet. So essentially, we did before COVID what other universities are doing now.
I recall some of the conversations around arts and music and various departments, a lot of passionate debate around how you make these decisions. How much did
Absolutely.
And how many people did you lose, basically? What was the cutting to cloth that happened in scale?
Well, I mean, in terms of the professional staff, we were proposing as part of our support services review at around 160. So those are non-academic staff. As everyone in New Zealand knows, we did close art history a few years ago, but by the same token, we've also just built a brand new music and theater building. If you were actually looking at it from a business perspective, there's absolutely no way you would do that, but we made the very brave decision that this university would continue to offer music and theater, which has been a fundamental part of our core curriculum, and so we invested the money in building the building that they needed to allow those subjects to continue to be taught here.
So the 160.
So we've made a lot of.
The 160 was non-academic staff. Did you lose academic staff as well?
Well, we lost academic staff in the closing of art history, in some of the changes that we made to humanities. I mean, we've made small cuts throughout the last 5 years in order to balance the books.
If there were one part of the one lever to pull, what would it be? You mentioned government controls price and it controls the number of students
volume.
As well, price and volume. Mm-hmm. That leaves one lever to pull, which is to increase what the universities are directly funded through the student achievement component. Would that be the answer, or do you believe something more fundamental needs to happen?
Well, I mean, that's one answer. There's a lot of small things that government could do. I mean, I gave you the example of the support for Māori and Pacifica students. We haven't seen an increase in the amount of money we get from government for a very large number of years. At Otago, $5 million in additional funding would be transformative for those groups of students. And so there are small things around the edges that government could easily do. But the increase in the student achievement component is something I think we're going to have to look at. But I also recognize that we're also facing, you know, one of the largest recessions in the history of New Zealand. So, you know, I'm not foolish enough to think that government's going to be throwing large sums of money at the universities right now. So universities are doing the only rational thing they can, which is to cut where they can so that they can continue to operate.
Grant Guildford, what is the way forward with respect to the international students? You've retained 80%. That's going to keep shrinking until there's new availability. I think 250 PhD students across the system, the government said, can come in around New Year. What are you hearing about whether there'll be a gradual increase over the course of next year? What have you been told?
So there's a cabinet paper released a few months ago which suggested that the new shape of international education is smaller numbers of high quality, as yet undefined, students coming back across the border. We understand that government understands that the nation is in a contest for global talent, and that's what the knowledge economy is built on, and so we have confidence that students of this quality will be allowed back into the country at some stage. We're hearing at the moment relatively small numbers for next year, though, so whilst our expectations leading into this year were that it might be back to near normal, those expectations were quite quickly walked back, so be in the order of 1,000 or 2 is what we're hearing.
Across the country?
Across the country.
What percentage would that represent?
That'd be about 1 or 2%
right.
of the international students across the country.
So to Professor Haynes' point, the real financial crunch may yet be to come from
here. Yes, next year and the year after will be the critical periods.
So what will universities do? Will they just... You've mentioned voluntary redundancies now, likely moving to compulsory at some institutions at least.
Yes, so cost control, looking for new revenue sources, and the cost controls will be operational and eventually staff will move from voluntary periods, voluntary actions, where and into directed compulsory actions if we need to. But for most of us at this stage, that's quite a way off. We're hoping that by managing our costs, our operational costs, by improving our revenues through that diversification we talked about, and by taking voluntary steps, we will be able to avoid those compulsory redundancies.
Before we welcome the Tertiary Education Unit, I'd like to ask each of you also about the feedback you've had about student experiences this year. Grant, we had a lot of criticisms about the lack of online access to Victoria during lockdown. I think the exams have been delayed. There's the challenge now of offering both online and face-to-face. Some institutions are actually cutting face-to-face exposure to traditional lectures. What's the feedback first from students that you've had?
Remarkably positive. So our course satisfaction rates are exactly the same as they were last year, which is a testament to the ability of our staff and the commitment of our students.
And the feedback from those same staff is?
Oh, the staff are very tired, so they've been working very hard for what we call this dual delivery, where they're having to maintain face-to-face teaching, as we might normally do, but also have a fully online program so that those vulnerable staff and students that can't return to work.
Is that sustainable, particularly if this goes on for another year or more?
No, I don't believe it is.
So what happens?
I think, well, that, if you take the financial challenges that we're just talking about and the resulting reduction in staff numbers, and then you add to that with a doubling of the workload for providing dual mode, you see an unsustainable system into the future that needs to be fundamentally altered. So we then need to think about how we're either funded by government or about the scope and spectrum of our teaching. So what is it that we're going to teach? Are we going to focus more narrowly? We can't continue doing what we're doing now.
Harlene Hain, could I ask you to comment, please, on your student feedback and your staff feedback to challenges?
I mean, it's pretty much exactly the same as Professor Guilford indicated. Our student satisfaction surveys indicate that students' satisfaction is exactly the same as it was last year. Our attrition rate is exactly the same as it was last year. Everyone's tired, but everyone has really risen to an unbelievable challenge. So I'm incredibly proud of both our staff and our students for what they've been able to achieve this year. We're about three quarters of the way through our exam period, and everybody is waiting for Christmas.
Thank you, and all the best with your overseas new venture, Harlene Hain, who is Vice-Chancellor of Otago University. Thanks also to the Vice-Chancellor of Victoria University of Wellington, Professor Grant Guilford. Michael Gilchrist is President of the Tertiary Education Union National. He's National President. Good morning, Michael.
Kia ora, Catherine.
Much to chew over. First of all, can we comment on what you are seeing around the risks of redundancies?
Yes, well, it's good to hear an acknowledgement that it's unsustainable the way we're going at the moment. We think, though, there are two areas in which we could do better, and that it does go to university management and councils, and also to the government. So first of all, in terms of 2021, we need universities to be prepared to run larger deficits. So the deficit target for 2021 for Victoria University is about 1% of their annual turnover. It's about 4%. They've got a deficit of about 4% this year. Surpluses, the requirement for a 3% surplus was intended to allow for some cash reserves to offset this kind of shock. And we need to see kind of proportionate deficits being prepared to be run, at least as a way of putting pressure on the government and at least as of illustrating the fact that this is an unsustainable situation.
So you believe they could run a bigger deficit than they're trying to?
Absolutely. 1% is a tiny deficit as a target for Victoria University, for example. The second thing is that there does need to be government funding increased to the SAC component, to, you know, the domestic funding
title,
component. Yeah, the student achievement component.
Right.
You know, domestic funding must increase to reduce our dependence on international students. That was the Labour Party's policy in the going into the 2017 election. It should still be the target, and we need to see more from government in that area. We need to hear from them that every student will be funded. Harlene mentioned that they control volume as well, that every student will be funded in 2021. We see huge increases in demand domestically coming, but we can't match that even with voluntary redundancies, that they will, you know, staff, the staff are being sacrificed in this system. And that actually has a huge impact on students. What we are concerned is that universities are reluctant to run sufficient deficits because they're reluctant to jeopardise what they call their autonomy, that is to say, their ability to manage themselves. Staff cannot be sacrificed on the altar of autonomy.
So they are worried that if they run bigger deficits, there'll be more direct government intervention, more hands-on intervention.
Yeah, I mean,
is that the case, Grant?
Yes, that's part of the reasons. We just also can't keep kicking the can up the road. So a deficit of $19 million this year and $30 to $40 next year would mean we're sort of $40 to $50 million.
But to Michael's point, this is a pandemic. We are hoping, like hell, that there'll be significant improvements within a year's time when it comes to the management of this pandemic. So you're looking at a 2 to 3 year hit.
Yeah, so we'd exhaust our debt capacity by the end of next year if we continue to spend at the rate we're spending. You'll often hear politicians talking about leveraging our balance sheet, but banks aren't interested in lending people to pay the power bill. They'll lend us as much money as we like to build a flash building, but not for operational deficits.
Michael?
There are other ways of managing that, and we are seeing that in the polytechnic sector. So Treasury can broker a system which splits the difference between lenders and borrowers. That's what's going to be happening with polytechnics this year. That's a well-established system. Well, it's a well-established system that where there are larger cash reserves, and let's remember that Auckland University, for example, has been making $80, $90 million surpluses in the last couple of years. That's, up to 80%. 8%, they're about a $1.1 billion organisation. There are cash reserves there. There are ways in which universities can help each other manage cash flows and provide credit.
The sustainability of what staff are doing at the moment with online and most courses also, there is some face-to-face teaching. We know some universities have, as I reference, the traditional lecture, whatever that is not being delivered face-to-face. There's the pressure on staff, but there's also the assessment of the effectiveness of these new models. Obviously, everyone thinks some online makes sense these days. The question is, who is assessing what is optimal when it comes to the actual teaching of students and the learning of students? And are you worried on both fronts? First, let's talk about how the staff are coping.
Well, what we've had up till now is emergency remote teaching. We have not achieved any kind of full conversion to optimal online conditions. We don't think that, we think that's limited what can be achieved in that way. We know that
students have been... But also you don't try and design a course optimally under pressure in an emergency,
as I say, it's great to hear, and Grant acknowledging that it is unsustainable for staff. But also staff conditions of work are student conditions of learning. Students do need face-to-face contact. We know that at every level. And there is a limit to what can be done in that way. And that huge increase in domestic students must be properly served. That pressure does need to go on the government as well then. There has to be some response from government. If they want tertiary education to be at the front line of our recovery from COVID-19, and that has been their explicit statement, so that they do want that. So that we can't continue as we are. There has to be give and take in both areas.
So apart from the fatigue and the stress on staff, are they also wanting to be part and parcel of how online is introduced?
Well, very much, but...
Rather than just, can you make this happen, please, and then that's the way it stays.
Yeah, I mean, it's important, though, to understand that even voluntary severances will have a negative effect on the overall situation. They aren't the answer, and in fact, they will make things worse. What we need is a carefully managed process in every case where it's thought that you could make some cuts in staff, but essentially we need to avoid further cuts in staff, not just because we're looking at up to 10% increase in domestic enrolments, but also a different future possibly with overseas students. And if you're going to teach properly online, you need as many staff to do that as you do face-to-face.
You may or may not have the same education minister this term. It depends which of his two enormous roles he remains in. Are you concerned at someone else, each of you, having to get up to speed quickly?
We are. We certainly hope that the current Minister of Education will continue. But we believe that there are some clear objective policy goals that the government has expressed in the past and must express for the future that will allow for the sector to be sustainable.
Your view?
Yes, well, I think we've enjoyed the idea of having the portfolio split with a tertiary education minister, because it is a massive portfolio, and currently Mr. Hipkins has got two very large portfolios, which would be impossible to manage well, even if you're superhuman.
So your view is education should definitely be split, whoever does it. All right. Thanks, both of you, very much. I appreciate it. Thanks also to Harlene Hayne earlier, Grant Guildford, and Michael Gilchrist, Tertiary Education Union National President.